You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Hey everyone, Tim McMaster here along with Steve Gilbert, our MLB.com D-backs reporter. And Steve, we're getting ready to head to Florida for the 2017 winter meetings in Lake Buena Vista, Florida, just next door, basically, or part of the Disney establishment. So we're going to look ahead to that a little bit. We're going to look also back at one of the more memorable D-backs winter meetings of the past. But let's take care of some news and notes before we get into that stuff. One of those news and notes, T.J. McFarland is back on a one-year deal. The team had non-tendered him. He's a success story to a degree from 2017 to the point where they kind of took him in at that point on a cheaper deal, and he pitched for them all season long. So do they expect more of the same, or would they like him to be even a little more effective in 2018?
Yeah, I think, Tim, when you look at T.J.'s season last year, there were a couple of outings that really – boosted his ERA up there. And one of them was an emergency start that he made in Minnesota, where he lasted only a third of an inning, gave up six or seven runs. It was kind of ugly. And that, when you're a reliever and you're not, you know, throwing that many innings, to have an outing like that and another outing against the Cubs where he gave up six runs, those really take its toll on your ERA. So I think if they're able to use TJ the way they did for much of last year, you know, bringing him in, especially against lefties, using him not necessarily in high leverage situations, but I think he can be effective. And certainly they were able to get him at a little bit lower than what they probably would have had to do via arbitration, unless he hits his incentives and has a big year. And in that case, he'll make a little bit more. And if he does that, they'll be happy to pay that a little bit extra for him.
The other player that they non-tendered was J.J. Hoover. Similar situation. Is there any chance he could return as well?
Yeah, I think they'll probably stay in touch with him and see if they could bring him back. Again, another guy that they brought in last year as a non-roster invitee to spring training, didn't allow a run during the spring, and pitched well at times for them during the year, but just somebody they didn't want to take the risk of going to arbitration with and having him win and have a guaranteed salary like that.
Makes a lot of sense. All right, let's look ahead to those winter meetings. And obviously, look at this D-backs team. There are some things to take care of. And obviously, the entire market has been slowed down by Shohei Ohtani and Giancarlo Stanton and those guys and where they're going to head. Now, the D-backs are out of the Ohtani sweepstakes. He picked his seven finalists, Arizona not one of them. So time to look elsewhere to fill the holes. What type of meetings do you expect from Arizona? Is this going to be a situation where they can get things done or where they're just kind of putting things in place, getting conversations going and looking to the next few weeks to a month to finish things?
Well, I think they're going to continue to try to look at three different areas. I think they'll look at trying to add to their bullpen depth. I think they need to add some catching depth, and they need to add some depth to their outfield. So whether or not they can work a deal during the winter meetings, we'll see. The Boxberger thing kind of came together because Tampa didn't want to. The Brad Boxberger thing kind of came together because Tampa didn't want to offer him arbitration. They were going to non-tender him, so they wanted to get something for him, and that's why that came to fruition before the winter meetings. So I think the Diamondbacks are going to continue to do what they've done last year, and that is kind of be in contact with a number of different teams, but kind of pick their spots here and there and wait for certain bargains to kind of come to them, as opposed to spending big money on a free agent. You know, last year they kind of waited, and it was during the winter meetings that they signed Fernando Rodney, who was coming off a rough second half. So, they might look to see if there's somebody on the market that who is not getting or the offers that maybe they expected, or maybe somebody available in trade, that they could get that's a controllable player and not overly expensive.
Starting to hear talk out there that Stanton could make up his mind about waiving his no trade clause by the end of the week, and Ohtani could also make a decision before the start of these winter meetings. If those two things happen, do you think this winter meetings has the chance, because everything has been so bottlenecked, that things could get crazy and we could have another kind of nuts winter meetings with all sorts of things going on, all sorts of teams involved, because suddenly everybody's
really
open to do it.
I do really do, because you bring up the great point that there are a lot of teams that are in on Ohtani or in on Stanton that are kind of put everything on hold until they hear back on that. And once that starts to happen, I think you'll start to see other outfielders start to go, and that could start the market going again when teams, you know, maybe they're not holding back a certain amount of money for these other deals or players for these other deals. I think then you'll see kind of a flurry of activity, because I think there's a lot of teams that have been put into a holding pattern while the teams involved with those two players are still kind of working things out.
All right, let's look back a little bit. 2009, one of the big trades of those winter meetings included the D-backs. It was the deal between the D-backs, the Yankees, and the Tigers. The D-backs acquired Edwin Jackson and Ian Kennedy to help out the rotation. The Yankees got Curtis Granderson from the Tigers, and the Tigers got Max Scherzer from the D-backs, Daniel Schlaer, Phil Koch, and they get Austin Jackson. Now, when you listen to all those names, obviously the one that stands out probably the most, I mean, there's some big names in there, but obviously Max Scherzer, and kind of one that got away for the D-backs, I guess. When they look back on this deal, do you take some positives from it because Ian Kennedy was a serviceable guy, or is this just the Max Scherzer trade?
Well, you know, now it looks like just the Max Scherzer trade, but I remember back in 2011, when Scherzer was still working to establish himself as an upper echelon pitcher, Ian Kennedy went 21-4 with a 2.88 ERA. I mean, he led the NL in wins on a Diamondbacks team that won the division that year. So at the time, it looked like, wow, that might be a really good deal for the Diamondbacks, because they ended up flipping Edwin Jackson the following year to the White Sox for Daniel Hudson, who had a big year in 2011. So he and Kennedy were at the top of that rotation and reasons why the Diamondbacks were able to win the division in 2011. So it's funny to see kind of how when you judge a trade immediately, when you judge a trade a few years later, and then when you look at it long term, how it can change so much. So sure, I think the Diamondbacks look at it as, you know, Max Scherzer got away, and but the open question is always, you know, would they have been able to afford him, because he got and kind of reached his potential just before his, you know, became a free agent, and with Kennedy and then with Hudson, they did get some value there. So a very interesting trade, and some big names in that trade, as you mentioned, Austin Jackson too, and Curtis Granderson. So there was a lot of talent that got traded there in that deal.
Great point. If the D-backs don't make that trade, maybe they don't make the postseason back then. And also, it is a good point. I mean, he went to Detroit and he was good, but he wasn't the Max Scherzer we know now, really, until, like you said, right before he reached free agency and signed that big deal with the Washington Nationals. So even if they had held on to him, they probably wouldn't have him right now. So I think you look back on that, and then certainly some short-term positives came out of it for the D-backs. So that was a good one, an interesting one for sure. You mentioned Fernando Rodney being something that happened a year ago. They're back in that same position now, right? But is there more of a feeling now that they don't have to get that closer because they have Archie Bradley if needed?
Yeah, and I think that, you know, getting Boxberger helps too in a sense that, you know, he provides some depth back there and he allows them flexibility. If a closer does fall to them, if they do have a deal out there that's reasonable, if they do find a free agent out there that's reasonable, they can still get that closer and guarantee them that they will close. That was one of the reasons that they were able to sign Fernando Rodney at such a reasonable price last year, is they were one of the few teams to tell them, hey, you're going to close for us. This year, again, without locking themselves into, hey, Bradley's the closer, hey, Boxberger's the closer, they could pull something like that again with somebody that's looking to go to a team where they can rebuild their value maybe and be pretty much assured that they're going to be the closer going in.
Great point all around. All right, well, the next time we talk, Steve, it'll be down in Lake Buena Vista, Florida. We'll actually be in person for a change at the winter meetings. I'm looking forward to it. This has been MLB.com Extras, our D-backs edition. For Steve Gilbert, I'm Tim McMaster. Tune in again next time. Hey, everyone, Tim McMaster here along with Chris Haft, our MLB.com Giants reporter, and the winter meetings right around the corner now. They get kicked off really Sunday night and then Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday before finishing things off next Thursday with the Rule 5 draft, Lake Buena Vista, Florida. right around Orlando down there in Florida. We'll all be there, Chris. It's going to be a lot of fun. The question now, I guess, is will Giancarlo Stanton and Shohei Ohtani have new homes before we get to Orlando? There's been some talk that those guys could make their decisions by the end of this week. What do you think?
You know, I'm thinking Stanton's trying to get the a lot of people agree, trying to get the Dodgers involved. It's obvious that's his first choice. I really think, and maybe this is a little bit cynical, but I really think if he wanted, I don't know about the Cardinals, but if he wanted to be a Giant or a Cardinal, yeah, I'll throw them in here. If he wanted to be with either of those two teams, he would have announced the decision by now. So I think he's trying to get the Dodgers involved. And as far as Ohtani, he's got, you know, seven teams to sift through. So he's got some thinking ahead.
Going back to Stanton a little bit, there was talk and there's rumors about the type of package that the Giants have apparently agreed to if it comes to that, if Giancarlo Stanton is up for waiving the no-trade clause. And there was talk of Arroyo, Shaw, Beedy, Ramos, basically the Giants' top four prospects being involved in this. Now, the Giants don't have the best farm system in baseball, but for any team to give up their top four prospects, that's a lot of guys, and if you don't have a great system, I mean, you talked about pros and cons in an article, Chris. I mean, that would leave them in an interesting spot as far as the minor league system.
Yeah, I think interesting. I'm going to take liberties with your word interesting. I'm going to translate interesting into meaning not good. I don't think any team wants to be in a position to have to give up, even if they are underwhelming prospects like the Giants are, or unproven relatively like Helio Ramos, the number four prospect who just started playing pro ball this year. No team wants to give up their top four prospects. And there was talk earlier that Joe Panik, the veteran second baseman, was in the package that the Giants would send to Miami, and therefore at least one of those prospects would not be in there. But they were hoping for Arroyo to play third. They were hoping for Shaw to provide some power. They were hoping for Ramos to come around, develop into a five-tool player, and they were hoping for Beedy to maybe win a rotation spot this season. So that's an awful lot to be given up.
Yeah, it certainly is. And obviously, in return, you'd be getting the National League MVP. So it's going to take something to give him up and a whole lot of contract that'll go with him as well. Definitely check out Chris's article about the pros and cons of Giancarlo Stanton, because it's a really good breakdown of both sides of this deal. It brings us to an interesting point in Giants history. Here's the spot right now where they're kind of making a run at getting one of the premier power hitters in the game via trade. That brings us back to 1992, 25 years ago. Hard to believe, Chris, that it was 25 years ago that they were able to sign Barry Bonds at the winter meetings. And it wasn't necessarily easy because the Giants were in an interesting spot right there. Ownership was changing hands. They were trying to get Barry Bonds. In the end, they signed him to the richest deal in Major League Baseball history. But just talk a little bit about the complications that kind of came about in the Barry Bonds negotiation and signing him 25 years ago.
Yeah, sure thing, Tim. I mean, they had Barry Bonds signed, sealed, and delivered. In a news conference called, it was going to be a big deal because everybody thought, Bonds was going to go to the Yankees. I mean, I think that's the automatic destination, default destination for big-time free agents. But I remember the whisper started, I think, in the morning of the signing, that there was a mystery team involved, and it turned out to be the Giants. They called a news conference, set it up, podium and everything. Barry Bonds marched in, started talking by. I remember because I was there in Louisville in 1992. Barry Bonds marched in, talked about how great it was to be a Giant, and then all of a sudden, somebody rushed the podium or somebody came on the podium and they talked in hushed tones and everybody left the podium. So it eventually became clear that, the Giants were in the process of being sold at the time to the group led by Peter McGowan from Bob Lurie. And Bob Lurie didn't want to be on the hook for that $43.75 million Bonds was going to get if for some odd reason Pierce group did not get final approval, which was expected, but, you know, still not done. So that's what canceled, that's what wiped out the first news conference. And then the lawyers got together, drew up some language that would protect Lurie from, you know, being liable for the contract. And so all's well that ends well. They had a second press conference. You know, Barry got to cry on cue, you know, talking about playing in the same park as his father and his godfather, Willie Mays. And so, you know, a good time was had by all.
And the rest is history, as they say. 15 seasons with the Giants and, of course, all the records and one of the all-time greats in San Francisco. And you said it before we started the podcast, Chris. You could argue, you could make a legitimate argument that that was the greatest free agent signing in the history of baseball, right?
Greatest free agent signing. But my, I feel, Tim, maybe in history of all sports, as far as how much he delivered. He didn't, you know, a lot of guys signed free agent contracts. They get hurt because they stopped training or maybe because they train too hard. They become subject to the pressure of, you know, trying to live up to that contract. I mean, no matter what you think of Barry Bonds, look at what he did. I would say the other guy close to him also comes from the sport of baseball, and that's Greg Maddux, and who also signed at those same meetings, you know, leaving the Cubs and going to the Braves. Look at what it's, you know, I don't even need to mention what he did. You know, it's, again, two of the best free agents ever signed, for sure.
Yeah, one pitcher, one hitter, remarkable stuff at that winter meetings. Another interesting story that came out, it's on Cut 4 right now for and Giants are on the Giants website as well, from the Bond situation, was that apparently they almost never got the chance to sign him because the previous year he was almost traded by the Pirates to, of all teams, the Braves that you just mentioned at the deadline. Basically, Jim Leland stormed the offices and said, there's no way you're trading this guy, and the Giants decided not to, and then eventually they lose him anyway. Or the Pirates decided not to. Eventually, they lose him anyway. So it's amazing how many things kind of came together for the Giants to finally get Barry Bonds, and what a career he had in San Francisco. All right, that'll do it for MLB.com Extras, our Giants edition. Chris, next time we do this podcast, we'll be together down in Florida at the winter meeting. So everyone, make sure you tune into that one. For Chris Happ, I'm Tim McMaster. Tune in again next time.
Hey, everyone. Welcome into another Padres podcast. Tim McMaster here along with our MLB.com Padres reporter, AJ Cassavell. And AJ, I think a week ago we said that the Padres had a chance at Ohtani, but it was probably a very small chance. And now, lo and behold, they're one of seven finalists, so those chances have certainly gotten better. He's expected to meet with those teams in the coming days, already meeting with the Giants on Monday. So now we need to seriously talk about what the chances are. And when you look at the Padres and Ohtani, we talked about the front office pieces a week ago and they have in there with the Japanese roots. But A.J. Preller also, right, has some history to a degree with Ohtani.
Yeah, and I think the entire Padres organization lends itself well to signing Ohtani. I think if you look at the seven teams that are remaining in the hunt, the Padres have to have as good a chance as any of them. There's a number of reasons for that. Andy Green was spent a year playing for Ohtani's team that he currently is with in Japan. There's Seiichiro Nakagaki, Ohtani's old trainer with Nippon Ham, is now the director of applied sports science for the Padres. There's a number of connections, and the Padres have pretty much to a man, everyone I've talked to about it, have kind of downplayed those connections. But in a recruiting process like this, when, I mean, we haven't seen a free agent kind of saga like this ever. In something like this, I don't think any connection is too small to go unnoticed. We don't know what would be the sticking point that could ultimately lead to Ohtani's decision-making. And the Padres, there's a number of reasons to be optimistic. And at this time a week ago, it didn't look as promising as it does now. Now I think the Padres have to be one of the favorites. They're at least one of the top seven.
Just being on the West Coast, obviously, has been a big plus, as well as right away Ohtani pretty much eliminated most of the country. Only Chicago and the Texas Rangers are the only teams not out on the coast that are still involved. So, how about the Christian Bethancourt factor. Here's a guy that the Padres have allowed to kind of go both ways. He's pitched, he's hit, he didn't really factor into the major league club the way they had hoped in 2017, but it just is more evidence that they're willing to allow a player to do this.
Yeah, and every single team is going to tell Ohtani, hey, we're willing to let you hit and we're willing to let you pitch and we're going to try and make a two-way player work. Every single team is going to say that because he's such a unique talent. Every team wants him. But the Padres have history to back that up with Christian Bethancourt, with what they tried last year. And while it didn't pan out, the Padres at least have already addressed some of the logistical kind of troubles that other teams would be taking on for the first time. Things like, I remember last spring having to balance Bethancourt's batting practice schedule with his bullpen session schedule. Little things like that in terms of when he would be available to pitch and when he would be available to hit. Now, obviously, Ohtani's a different case because he'd be a starter, but it's clear that the Padres are committed to something like this, whereas, and I obviously can't get into Ohtani's head in terms of what he's thinking, other teams could potentially be less genuine in the sense that obviously they want him as a pitcher, but if he struggles a little bit as a hitter, are they willing to keep that? Are they willing to keep the two-way experiment up? I think the Padres have really proven their open-mindedness to something like this already.
So we will keep an eye, obviously, on all the rumors and everything and updating Twitter and all that stuff as that decision probably still at least a few days, if not a week or so away, but he's got to meet with all the teams and finally make up his mind. He has over 2 weeks until he has to make up his mind. All right, so AJ Preller, since the last time we spoke, has signed a 3-year extension with the Padres. And you look back on the Preller tenure so far in San Diego, and it's kind of fascinating, AJ. He obviously went all in right away, and it kind of backfired. It didn't work. But he was quickly able to kind of turn things 180 degrees and start to rebuild this team the other way by going with a youth movement. All of that in not that long a time frame. And you look at where this team is right now, and there is a lot of young talent in the system. It's kind of fascinating. You throw a 30-day suspension in there as well, and he has had an eventful stint.
Yeah, and what the contract extension does more than anything else is kind of provide some stability. It's been a up and down first 3 years of Preller's tenure. But if you look at the next half decade, the Padres extended manager Andy Green earlier this year. They extended Will Myers last offseason. Their young core, the guys who they think are going to help lead them into contention, Austin Hedges, Manuel Margot, Hunter Renfro, they're all under control through 2022. In fact, they only have three players who will become free agents before 2020. So this team is really kind of constructed. The pieces are in place where they're not going to be losing anything. Now it's a matter of building around those guys and developing some of the prospects. And this has been Preller's vision all along, and the contract extension, what it does is basically cements the fact that he will be in place to see that vision through.
I mentioned the suspension, and that stemmed from maybe the best way to put it is just like covering up injuries or not being completely honest about injuries and things like that. Did he have to win back ownership after that a little bit?
He did. I think anytime you break the rules, it's upon you to take some responsibility for it. Preller did exactly that, and I think the ownership kind of gave him full backing with the caveat that, hey, nothing like this can ever happen again. And the ownership loves the plan Preller has in place. They love the way he's kind of revamped the entire farm system and got everyone on the same page going forward. The suspension stemming from it was the withheld medical information in the Drew Pomerantz trade. Ultimately, that trade kind of ended up. I don't want to say hurting the Padres, but Anderson Espinosa, who they acquired for Pomerantz, he underwent Tommy John surgery last year, and so. It going forward, I think the ownership group has full faith in Preller, and they kind of showed that with this extension.
All right, let's look back upon AJ Preller's first winter meetings. You have a story coming out about winter meetings past in 2014. During the meetings, which actually took place in San Diego, the Padres, the home team, didn't do a lot as far as actually getting things done and press releases going out, but they did do a lot of work, and that work paid off in the next couple of weeks, as I mentioned, them going all in, and that was really the winter when that happened. Just take us back a little bit to 2014 and all the big-time moves that Preller was able to make right away after taking over this team.
Yeah, it was kind of he was the rock star GM, as Matt Kemp called it. He acquired Kemp, Will Myers, and Justin Upton kind of in a very short span in December. All of those trades, the Padres moved significant pieces in their system and even on their major league roster. It was a complete and total shakeup, and what it did was kind of, I mean, it ultimately didn't pan out. The Padres won 74 games that year, but it got people talking about the Padres. It got people talking about Preller, and it was an extremely eventful offseason. Later in the offseason, obviously, the Padres would acquire James Shields and Craig Kimbrell. But I think those winter meetings were especially key in laying the groundwork for some of those trades. And now looking back, I think the general consensus in the organization isn't that it was a failed plan. It's that there was a plan that didn't work out that is kind of almost still going on. They acquired Craig Kimbrell for prospects. They didn't win. They traded Craig Kimbrell for prospects. And now some of those prospects, Manuel Margot, Carlos Asuaje, are paying dividends at the major league level. Will Myers is still a part of the Padres' backbone for the next few years. And so I think what we saw from A.J. Preller's philosophy has definitely changed since his first winter meetings. But what we saw in those winter meetings was a willingness to be bold and to make moves and to take chances. And he certainly hasn't stopped doing that.
All right, so let's look ahead to a week from now, Orlando, Florida, the site of the 2017 winter meetings. Do you expect the Padres to be busy, or is it going to be a quieter week for San Diego?
I think it's going to be a lot busier than it was a year ago. Last year was quiet up until the Rule 5 draft. The Padres have some holes to fill on their pitching staff, and I know they're exploring trade options with some starting pitchers, but it's probably likelier that they go via the free agent route. Obviously, they're going to be at the forefront of the Ohtani discussion, depending on whether that lingers over into the winter meetings. There's some offensive holes they need to fill, too. Eric Hosmer is a guy that's been discussed. I don't know how real those talks are, but if they are, I'm sure they'll ramp up soon. They really need a shortstop. They're weighing whether that's a position they need to trade for, or that's a position where they can sign someone as a stopgap for Fernando Tatis Jr., one of their top prospects. But there's a lot that the Padres need to resolve on their major league roster. I don't know if they're going to be making any major splashy moves like Hosmer or Ohtani. Obviously, they'd love to, but that remains to be seen. But there's still a lot to get done, and I think they will be busy, at least in the sense of moving some pieces and trying to get some guys on board before the new year.
All right, we look forward to it. And next time we speak, AJ, it'll be down there at the winter meetings. We'll do this podcast in person, so I look forward to that. This has been MLB.com Extras, our Padres edition. For AJ Cassavell, I'm Tim McMaster. Tune in again next time.
Hey, everyone, Tim McMaster here along with our MLB.com Rockies reporter, Thomas Harding. And, Thomas, we're not at the winter meetings yet. We'll be there in a couple of days, but the Rockies already filling some of their needs here before we even make it down to Florida for the 2017 winter meetings, as it's announced here on Friday afternoon that they've inked Chris Iannetta, or agreed to a deal with Chris Iannetta to be their catcher. That was obviously one of the things they had to take care of. There was talk of maybe it being Jonathan Lucroy returning, but in the end, Chris Iannetta is the guy. Talk about this deal, how he fits with the Rockies.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting because this just happened moments before we did this podcast, and what we're trying to find out on this is this. He was Iannetta, originally with the Rockies. He was on the 2017 that went to the playoffs, and I mean World Series, and also the 2019. Has moved around a bit and kind of has a reputation for being able to handle young pitchers. He was with the Diamondbacks last year. He was in a tandem with Jeff Mathis. So the question that I have is, you know, what the plan is with Iannetta now. I mean, they do have a couple of young catchers that look like they could be good ones in Tony Walters. And also Todd Murphy, although he struggled a bit last year, this is a guy with a power bat. So what happens? Does Iannetta come in as part of that tandem with one of those guys? Or do the Rockies continue to go after somebody like a Jonathan Lucroy that they had last season and have Iannetta as part of that tandem? That's the question we have. I mean, with Iannetta coming in, he's a guy that managers trust a bit. So it really makes a difference to a young staff. I know going into last season, they went with a young catching duo before they signed Ryan Hannigan. They had Tony Walters and also just young guys with Tony Walters, and that was through the first half. They were pretty good, but they just weren't quite able to get that young staff with young catching where they wanted. So that's why they went out and traded for Lucroy.
Yeah, now they have another veteran to help. All right, so let's look ahead to those winter meetings a little bit. One thing checked off with catcher taken care of, but there are other things that this team needs to accomplish, not necessarily next week, but over the course of this off season. And next week is obviously a big jumping out point to do just that. A year ago, they made a key move and signed a big deal with Ian Desmond. Do you expect this winter meetings to be a little quieter?
Not necessarily, because they have that closer position open. And do they go after Greg Holland or Wade Davis? I know that they have talked to both of those guys in the time leading up to the winter meetings. So will they be going with this long-term, big-money contract? They stayed out of it last year, but that was because Greg Holland dropped into their laps. He was coming off of Tommy John surgery. Obviously, Greg Holland now, after a good year with the Rockies, will be looking for a multi-year deal. Wade Davis the same way, coming out of the Chicago Cubs. They've also made some contact with Brandon Kinsler. Now, looking at his style of pitching, he doesn't strike out guys the way that you would expect your closer to, but you could see bringing him in as a primary setup guy to where if something happened to your closer, then you go to him. Do they go after setup guys like that or veterans like that and try to stay in-house with, say a Carlos Estevez or even an Adam Ottavino who came off of a rough year last year, or do they get into this free agent closer market where they tie themselves to a multi-year deal to a pitcher? It'll be interesting to see what the Rockies do, because after going to the playoffs last year, it may be a little bit different expectation. You know, you want to kind of have the ninth inning really settled with a guy you believe in. Another possibility would be a trade. I mean, a guy like Alex Colomé with the Tampa Bay Rays, there's some control with him for the next few years, so you could get a good young pitcher and not spend what you spend on a Holland or Davis. So there are many options for the general manager, Jeff Breidich.
That's a great point. A year ago, they were able to wait and wait and wait and get Greg Holland really late in the game. But now that there is that added extra expectations on this team as a team that went to the playoffs, you probably don't want to do that. You want to take care of business a little bit earlier. All right, let's look back on some winter meetings past. You have a story up on the site right now, Thomas, about the 2000 winter meetings. That was the year that the Rockies made a big splash. 8 years, $121 million, the deal that they gave to Mike Hampton. That was the big story of that winter meetings from a money standpoint. Unfortunately for the Rockies, his time in Colorado certainly did not last those full 8 years. And this was a time where I think they thought they could bring in big-name pitchers to pitch in Coors Field. And maybe Mike Hampton was one of the first big-name guys that has made them realize now that maybe it's better to develop these guys from within.
Well, it's interesting because before Mike Hampton, if you remember, they had that Daryl Kyle here. Daryl Kyle had pitched in Houston and then came to Colorado and ended up getting traded to St. Louis and helping that team go to the World Series. So the Rockies are sitting here thinking, hey, it didn't work that time, but they had come off of an 82-80 season, and what happened in 99, they really struggled, bottomed out a bit. But then in 2000, Dan O'Dowd was in his first year as general manager, and Buddy Bell was the first year manager. They ended up winning 82 games, kind of piecing things together, using 25 different pitchers. So they're thinking, wait a second, maybe we can try again to settle the pitching. Not only did they sign Hampton to that unbelievable deal, but they also signed Danny Nagel for 5 years and $51 million. And so there is $172 million wrapped up in two pitchers. For the first half of that season, it looked pretty good. I mean, Nagel was, I believe, 5-3 at the break. Hampton was the first All-Star in Rockies history, first All-Star starting pitcher. Of course, we forgot about that because things went south pretty quickly. They actually, I think, were going south around that time. For whatever reason, Hampton couldn't have a consistent sinker here in Denver, and it looked like he was trying to just miss bats instead of attack hitters, and it all went to pieces in a hurry.
Yeah, and then in two seasons, 21 and 28 was the record for Mike Hampton, and then he was part of a big trade from there as the Rockies
send him and Juan Pierre and some money to the Florida Marlins. They got Vic Darrensborg, Charles Johnson, Pablo Azuna, and Preston Wilson in return. So that's how the Mike Hampton in Colorado era came to an end. But it's always fun to look back on winter meetings past and the teams that kind of win the offseason and win the season and how it all shakes out. Sometimes you win, sometimes you lose. Another note from the last week that I wanted to touch on with you, Thomas, is that Chad Bettis has collected another award. He wins the Tony Conigliaro Award, obviously for his return from testicular cancer, and the Tony C Award, named after the great slugger of the Boston Red Sox, who was on record-setting home run paces before he was struck by a pitch and his career was cut short after that. So the award goes to a major leaguer who has overcome adversity through the attributes of spirit, determination, and courage that were trademarks of Tony C. Just a neat award for Chad Bettis, who deserves so much credit for what he's been able to do in coming back. And I think he really inspired people in 2017.
Boy, I have to say, I have to commend the people in Boston, the Baseball Writers Association, the local Sports Hall of Fame, and also Tony Conigliaro's family, because that is one of not only the great awards just in baseball, but I think in all of sports. And what a story about Tony C. Back in the day, I remember the famous Sports Illustrated cover where his eye is completely just swollen shut after being hit with a pitch. Chad Bettis, I mean, what can you say about that guy? He on his wedding anniversary, he received news that he had cancer, testicular cancer. It was something he noticed right away. And they did surgery a few days later, but the cancer had spread to a lymph node, so he had to undergo chemotherapy. And he is a guy that thinks things through in ways that other people just simply don't. So while he was ready to undergo chemotherapy, they explained to him, hey, there's a port that we insert into you, and that's where we deliver the medicine. And usually it's under a collarbone. And Chad Bettis thinking, gee, which collarbone? And he asked the doctors, why not put it under the left collarbone? That way, in between treatments, he would go out and just do some throwing. And he greeted the team in Arizona during a regular season road trip. You know, he lives in Scottsdale. And he did his throwing program there, and everybody got to see him. His hair hadn't come back, but you saw the smile. And then a few months later, the beard, the hair, it's back. The throwing arm is back. And he throws 7 shutout innings in his first game. Struggled a little bit down the stretch, but his last regular season game, he really shut down the Dodgers. And had the Rockies won in that wild card game against Arizona, he would have faced the Dodgers in one of the postseason games, and that story would have grown even bigger. But no matter what happened, his ability to fight through that and his attitude just rubbed off on a whole lot of people, and it was a great thing.
Absolutely, and he'll be hopefully he'll be a big part of this Rockies rotation going forward into 2018. And beyond. That's going to do it for this podcast. Next time we do this, Thomas will be in person down in Florida at the winter meetings. I look forward to it next week.
Definitely look forward to it.
All right, that'll do it for MLB.com Extras, our Rockies edition. For Thomas Harding, I'm Tim McMaster. Tune in again next week.
Hey, everyone, Tim McMaster here, along with Ken Gernick, our MLB.com Dodgers reporter. And, Ken, we're getting close to the winter meetings coming up next week in Orlando, Florida. During the podcast here, we're going to look back on the Dodgers' 2014 winter meetings. I remember a late night in that one as far as the Dodgers go out on the West Coast. Before we get to that, though, I wanted to touch on the big news going on right now, and that continues to be Giancarlo Stanton and also Shohei Ohtani. Now, Ohtani has limited the list now. It seems like 7 teams have kind of made it through the preliminary round, and the Dodgers, obviously, one of them. No surprise there. The West Coast, it seemed like, was something that maybe would be something Ohtani would be interested in. All 7 teams actually have their spring training facilities in Arizona, so that also interesting. As you look at it now, have you heard when the Dodgers plan to meet at all with Ohtani?
No, the Dodgers aren't talking about it, and really Ohtani's people aren't talking about it either. Most of this is coming out second and third hand. But it, you know, there is a deadline of the 22nd for him to make a decision, so there won't be a delay in this. They're on a pretty strict timetable, so
you know, whether that means it gets done before or after the winter meetings or even during the winter meetings. But it's all going to be wrapped up in the next couple of weeks. So I would think that these meetings will begin almost immediately. And, you know, and he's going to have to make a decision before Christmas.
And he is in, or he was in Los Angeles over the weekend. So you wonder if he starts with the LA teams, as it's been reported that the Angels are also one of the finalists for him. There was a lot of talk before he was actually posted. What exactly would he be looking for? Would the international money matter at all at this point? Of course, none of it being huge sums, but it seems like, you know, with the Yankees already out of the running and teams like that, that really it is coming down to the factor that money isn't that big a deal for Ohtani, and it's going to be other things. And obviously the Dodgers' first sales pitch, which wasn't face-to-face, was a successful one since they're still in the running.
Well, I don't think money was ever an issue, right, or he would have waited 2 years to come over when he would have been a true free agent. So clearly money's not it. Nobody really knows, at least publicly, what his primary goal is beyond being a two-way player. I think that's everybody's in agreement that he wants to pitch and hit. That might even be a higher priority than to win right away. You know, winning right away, there's a, you know, when you have the chance to win, there's also the pressure to win right away. And he's only 23, and he's never played in the major league. So maybe he's looking for a team. You know, several of these teams are second division clubs, you know, losing clubs, teams that seem to be rebuilding, like the Padres and the Mariners, the Giants. So it seems like if you're judging by the cutdown, not only does he want to train in Arizona, but, you know, quite a few of these teams really have a long way to go before they're competitive. So maybe he's looking for a team kind of out of the spotlight, maybe a role out of the spotlight, not to be the guy, the savior, but maybe to have a few years to kind of transition to major league style of play and be able to withstand the demands of being a pitcher and a hitter.
That's a great point, that maybe it takes a little bit of that pressure off. And obviously New York would have been a whole different level of pressure if he had ended up being interested in the New York Yankees, where they're about ready to start winning big time again, and plus the circus that is playing for the New York Yankees. All right, so the other big story, obviously, Giancarlo Stanton. And it sounds like the Marlins have agreed to, I guess, trades in theory with the Cardinals and also the Giants. But Stanton has continued to say that he wants to be on the Dodgers. We continue to not hear anything really from the Dodgers on backing that up. So it seems like we're at the point right now, Ken, where Stanton is going to have to make a decision on whether or not he'll accept the trade to the Cardinals or the Giants. And he may have to make up that decision before he knows for sure if the Dodgers could ever become a suitor. Or do you think that, you know, he's at the point where he's just going to wait out things and hope for the Dodgers?
Well, you know, a lot of people have said that he's got all the leverage. I've never agreed with that. In some ways, he's got very little leverage. He's got to go to a team that the Marlins can trade him to, and he can't determine that. He can say all he wants. He wants to be a Dodger. He probably should have thought of that, about that before he signed a 10-year deal. you know, the three-year option, I mean, the opt-out after 3 years, you know, he can revisit that. But right now, he can't determine where he goes, but he can determine where he doesn't go, really. And if all they present him with are two teams that he doesn't want to go to, then he's going to have to stay with the Marlins. The Dodgers, unless they veer off course from what they've been doing, they don't want to pick up roughly $500 million in salary, which is what it would be when you factor in the luxury tax. And that just runs counter to everything they've done. Besides, this isn't a team that needs a guy to put them over the top. They were one win away from winning a World Series. So to commit $500 million when you're one win away from the World Series, you know, it just sort of really doesn't make financial sense, and it isn't the way that they've been running things. So unless he somehow falls in their lap at some discount, which, you know, I guess it would require something really creative, like tearing up his contract or something, you know, beyond anything that's been speculated so far, I just don't see how he becomes a Dodger this winter.
Yeah, agreed on that completely. And I think it's going to be whether or not he can handle to make that decision on whether or not he wants to go ahead and just go somewhere other than Miami or stay and wait. And as you mentioned, he can opt out of that deal. So maybe if he really, really wants to play for the Dodgers that bad, he can wait a couple more years till he can opt out of that contract and try to work something out with them. All right, the winter meeting's a week away. Let's take a look back on one of the craziest winter meetings was 2014, and the Dodgers were a big part of that. Really, it all came together in one night. And I remember, Ken, that was a late night for a lot of people, even on the West Coast, but especially for people who were covering the winter meetings back on the East Coast because they were taking place on the West Coast. But in 2014, a whole bunch of trades. The Dodgers traded for Jimmy Rollins. They sent D. Gordon, Dan Herron, Miguel Rojas to the Marlins. They got Andrew Haney, Austin Barnes, Enrique Hernandez, Chris Hatcher back. They flipped Haney for Howie Kendrick. I mean, it was madness for a little bit there. What do you remember most about that slew of moves the Dodgers made really quickly?
Right. You know, I've covered winter meetings where the Dodgers have made maybe one or two trades that might have had a greater impact as far as those individual players go. But for the amount of deals that happened in a short period of time, and the fact that it was Andrew Friedman's first winter meetings in charge of the Dodgers, you know, it really kind of announced that this new front office had taken charge. They sort of took over the meetings, and they showed kind of how bold they would be. And, you know, not every trade worked out great, not every signing. You know, also at that winter meeting, they made some contract agreements with Brandon McCarthy. They set up a deal with Fred Anderson. So it was a winter meetings where while it didn't really immediately lead to a World Series or anything, it did really tear apart the roster that Friedman had inherited from Ned Colletti, and it kind of allowed him to put his stamp on it and also sort of announce to baseball that that you've got a new guy in charge of this team and he's going to wheel and deal. Not that Colletti didn't make his share of moves. He sure did. But there were so many moves that kind of reshaped this team. You know, Matt Kemp to San Diego. I mean, not every deal was completed during the beginning to end of that winter meetings, but it basically took shape that offseason, that whole roster turned over, and they got Yasmani Grandal. They just made so many deals in so short a time that, you know, it's a winter meetings I'll never forget.
Yeah, absolutely. You mentioned, you know, Grandal, they got him, and Austin Barnes in that D. Gordon trade is a guy that a reason why you have to wait on these trades to find out how they pan out for teams is this was 2014, and then we saw this year, 2017, suddenly Austin Barnes becoming such a big part of this postseason run. It makes that D. Gordon trade look even better on the Dodgers side of it.
Right, and, you know, Enrique Hernandez, who has been kind of a role player and he played so well in the league championship series with that three homer game against the Cubs. So, you know, like I said, not every deal worked out. I mean, they traded Andrew Haney for Howie Kendrick. You know, Kendrick, you know, served a purpose. He filled a hole. Haney's, you know, had his injury problems, but, you know, he's still considered a pretty good prospect. You know, they got Jimmy Rollins, but, you know, that didn't work out, although they really only got him to kind of hold a place until Corey Seager was ready, and that kind of accelerated. Seager took his job at the end of that next season. So, you know, there were mixed results. Chris Hatcher was supposed to be the setup guy, and that never really worked out. But Yasmani Grandal has performed, you know, reasonably well, had an all-star year. They were able to unload a lot of the salary of Matt Kemp. So, you know, the results were mixed. You know, Brandon McCarthy has had some good moments, but he's also been hurt. Mixed results as far as the performance, but you sure can't take away from the fact of the boldness, you know, and the vast numbers of players that changed uniforms during that winter meeting.
All right, so looking ahead to the 2017 winter meetings down in Orlando, Florida in a week, obviously the Ohtani situation could bleed over into the winter meetings or even through them possibly. But beyond that, you mentioned the luxury tax and how the Dodgers are trying to come down there eventually and get under that at some point. Do you expect this to be a busy winter meetings or quieter on the Dodgers front?
Well, you know, if you exclude the Ohtani aspect, I think it will be more as far as, you know, on the margins. You know, they they really made their big moves last offseason when they brought back Kenley Jansen and Justin Turner and Rich Hill. That was a big outlay of almost $200 million to keep the core of the team together with long-term contracts. So when you consider that, Clayton Kershaw has an opt-out after next year. So that's going to be an issue kind of lingering in the background. But, the Dodgers just, as I've mentioned, they were one win away from winning a World Series. This isn't a team that needs to rebuild. They need to bolster the bullpen. You know, if Brandon Morrow leaves, they need a setup guy. If Tony Watson leaves, they probably need another left-handed reliever. But we're talking about kind of complementary pieces. We're not talking about mainstays. They may want to re-sign Yu Darvish if they don't wind up with Ohtani. They may be looking for a number two or three starter. But in general, you're talking about bench. You're talking about role players. And Ohtani has been the focus really since the middle of summer, when Andrew Friedman took Oral Hershiser to Japan to watch Ohtani work out. He's been their focus. He's been their number one priority. And so, everything that they do will pretty much be dictated by what happens with him.
All right, great stuff, Ken. Next time we catch up, it'll be down there in Orlando at the winter meetings. This has been MLB.com Extras, our Dodgers edition. For Ken Gernick, I'm Tim McMaster. Tune in again next time.